So we are now going to very quickly take advantage of the fact that we've got another lady here today, Jill Gorrell-Barnes. Jill has worked at the Tavistock Clinic, and she is a Newhamite, of course, going to give us...
What else could one be?
Jill is going to give us some of her insights, and I'm going to stand back and let her take the stage.
So I am not going to summarise those very interesting presentations we've had this morning, but I want to try and interdigitate a bit. I've been working on a book which is about fathers who are not all of you and your parents and probably your children and their husbands. I'm writing about the disengaged, disempowered fathers. I've worked in child and family mental health all my professional life since the 60s. I worked with step families as a particular project, interviewing children from the 1958 birth cohort in their 30s, and we looked at the difference between their ideas on biological fathers and social fathers, the stepfathers. We then did a divorce project at the Tavistock in the Department of Children and Parents, looking at families going through divorce and interviewing, in the context of that, the fathers in their changing roles as they move from being in intact families to taking on post-divorce fathering roles. And then as a result of that, I got very interested in fathers especially, and I started doing a project with one of my colleagues which was focusing on fathers as first carers, as primary carers. And this was looking at fathers culturally diverse, because we used a snowball model, and also class diverse. But because both my colleague and I, our mothers either died or had strokes in the middle of this project, and we had to put it on hold because we didn't have any resources to employ other workers. So my book, really, now, I then went into court work. So I'm just explaining my trajectory of life with fathers and work with fathers in the context of the family court for 15 years. And those are fathers who are either seeking contact with their kids because they lost it after conceiving them. And those are the fathers that have just been referred... Is it Robert? Sorry. Bruce just referred to as the sperm bank firers. But some of them weren't. Some of them actually had short-term cohabitations or quite serious liaisons for a year, but then got marginalised or displaced by the women with whom they were living, who didn't really think they were up to scratch. So we then got to a very interesting question of what are fathers for many women? And I thought what I'd just do, given that we've got a very short time, we've got some discussion this afternoon, is tell you a little bit about what I've tried to cover in terms of the field of fathers that we haven't talked about so far. I must just say, though, before I do that, this is to Robert, I think. I'm getting a bit muddled with my three. Oh, Jonathan, that I was one of those wives who was interviewed to see whether I would be fit for my husband to have a position in a bank. And I it was really all about whether you knew where to put your knives and forks and how to speak proper. So, you know, I moved from those days through to those wonderful models that you were offering of how women can be positioned and offer role models in the city, which was totally unthinkable in the 60s. I remember the one woman who was employed as she reached assistant director. And they just took the piss out of her the whole time. She was teased, she was bullied, there was gender bullying, there were rude remarks about her sexuality. You know, it was a place that I really don't think young women now, hopefully, will have to know about. So what we have to think about is how men have had to change their positions in relation to women also gaining power. That's partly the woman's movement, but it is also what men like Jonathan and his colleagues have made possible for women in the changing field of business. And I think that's, we have to think about men in relation to women, women in relation to men, all the way through. So I think this is a really interesting project that you have here, which is an ongoing examination of thinking about fatherhood. So in my personal life, I'll just say that I am a mother of two, a stepmother of three. I've got 11 grandchildren, and they range from 26 to 3. So I've got grandsons growing up into becoming fathers, and I have quite an investment in the sort of future they might have. But the men that I've been working with and looking at over the years include the changing social context for fathering, and I've really begun with my own father during the war, because I had a very untraditional family. My mother was the main full-time worker, and I worked in the film industry and worked incredibly long hours, and my dad was more the nurturing parent. And that was so subversive, you know, in the 50s. I didn't realise then how different it was from most women of my age's experience. But of course it's made me very positive about men and what they can do in the home, and I think that's part of where my own interest was generated. I then had a stepfather, because my mother decided my father wasn't manly enough, and both of them could cook, my father and my stepfather, so I'm now teaching my grandson, age 3, to cook, because I think it's an essential attribute for all men who want to become nurturant fathers. So in this book, I'm looking at the changing social context for fathering. What are our expectations of fathers within different ethnicities and cultures in the UK today? And how can we get men to think about what being a father will entail? Because the old patriarchal model of rights over children is still very prevalent in men's minds, in spite of all the changes, you know, that we're working on. When a man is under threat, and you get this particularly in post-divorce work, but you also get it in work where men are seeking their children, the assumption that they have a right over a child is still what anxious men fall back on, rather than thinking about responsibility and what they could offer both the woman who has borne their child and the child. So that's a major piece of work that has to be done. And then I look at becoming a father in young, vulnerable fathers in situations where they won't have a home, so that their fatherhood will be in the context of the wife's family, very probably. So you have to look at extended kinship networks. How will that affect the way a man thinks about himself as a father, and how he can perform fatherhood? And I think if we can all think today about performing fatherhood, and what do we as women, or what do you as younger women, want and expect from men in role, in household, that's a huge first step, because very often nobody's really got a clue, and it just evolves through fights, you know, as the relationship develops, which isn't the best way of doing it. So I've looked at research, massive research, about secure father-child attachments, and I was interested that Robert actually talked about laughter and play quite a lot, because that is one of the things that shows up as something men do well. But of course women then say, well, maybe men do that well because we women are doing all the hard work, so they can afford to laugh and play. But he was doing the hard work and he was still thinking about laugh and play, so that's good. And I look at this business of some of the negative dangers in assisted fertilisation. I've seen quite a few young fathers who gave sperm to a partner in the belief that they were then going to become fathers to the child with the woman, but got the push, you know, and nobody had helped them think about, if you want to be in there, you have to put the time in, both with the relationship and with the child in the first few months of life. You can't just expect that because this is biologically your child, you're going to get a relationship with the child. So this is a little danger zone. We just have to be aware, with the increase of fertilisation, assisted fertilisation, to go on nurturing a relationship, because it can be a very hazardous process, as any of you have been through it know, even if you're doing ICSI or assisted fertilisation in other ways. A woman can get very alienated from the man because she has to relate so much to the medics and to the whole business of nurturing the egg. So that's the beginning. Then I look at the business of picking up fatherhood. I haven't got time to say much about that now. But really the whole question of biological versus social fathering. How do you develop social fathering in men? And then I look at post-divorce hostility, because we've got a huge group of fathers who don't live in the home but are still trying to be nurturant fathers. And we have to think again, and I think this means that as women, mothers, we still have a responsibility to bringing up children, boys, and the girls who are their sisters, with the idea that they will become people who relate to children. So it means really starting right at the beginning, in my view. You have to develop secure attachments for men in their families, but also with the idea that they will offer those to children. And it's a lifelong project. Step families, I've mentioned, we've looked at, and I'd be delighted to talk about those, but I don't think we have time now. And of course, mental illness, it's one of the undiscussed aspects of our social world. Both my husband and I work in mental health and do projects that relate children and parents, because it's a very neglected area. The adult mental health services don't attend to children, and child mental health services often don't feel equipped to take on the parents and work with them. And it's a very large aspect of, I'm sure many of you know, of life, even with people functioning well in institutional worlds. They often break down in family worlds. We're learning more and more about neurobiology and how we can bring that thinking into our ideas about plasticity of the brain, and therefore how we can work with things like violence. And I think that's another very important domain for us as women to think about with men. Anger, as Bruce said, and how you can help men think about disappointment in relationship, and also often feeling that they're not good enough as fathers when their anger breaks through. And I think we, I'm afraid, have a huge responsibility through the institutions we've offered men. I think public schools have, and sending children away very young, have a huge amount to answer for, but equally so do being looked after institutions. You know, children taken away from home at a young age don't do well very often. So that we need again to think about nurturing men. Now, whether this is women's responsibility has been an ongoing debate, you know, since I was at university. So I'm not unaware that it is often thought that men should do that for themselves, but I don't believe they can. I think we have to do it systemically. And then I look at parental alienation, because there's a huge amount of work on how mothers can deliberately, you know, split their kids off from fathers. And this is where my little girl, who was 4, said to me, "What can a man do that a woman can't do?" she said, when her father tried to meet her. She had 2 sisters. She said, "I don't need one. What does a man do that a woman can't do?" And then she sort of went through a list of all the things that her mum could do and her sisters could do. And she said, "You know, Dad hasn't been around enough. We don't trust our dad." And a 9-year-old boy said, "I've got a mum and I've got a good grandpa. Why do I need a dad? What will a dad add to that?" So there is a lot in the work I've done which is about the marginalisation of fathers. And then, of course, we've also got the very excellent work by Susan Gollenbach on gay parents and Fiona Tasker on gay fathers, which is looking at the fact that a homosexual couple can do as well as with a child, a mother and a father. So that's another area from which attack on fatherhood is coming. And we haven't got enough research into gay fatherhood yet to really know what the differences are. But we're moving more towards parenting rather than fathering in a lot of the discourses. And I understand exactly what Bruce is talking about when he talks about men's anxiety in relation to what becoming a father means. So I think this is another very interesting thing for us to talk about. So my question has been, how do children, families, but children especially, thrive without fathers? But equally importantly, how do fathers thrive without children? Because I think there's nothing more dispossessing for a man than to be alienated, cut off from his children. Because in my experience, it's where that second source of generating love and opportunity for growth comes from, the father with his kids. So I'll stop there.